On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Evaluating LNAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover introductory material very quickly today and then turn the training over to our trainers from the ITRC LNAPL team. As listed on the slide, today's training is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance, Evaluating LNAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. We're going to introduce you to this guidance during today's training class, but the guidance itself is also available for you to download, and we do encourage you to download the guidance and use it in your work. We're going to take you to the link, a link at the end of the training where you can download the guidance. You're also able to download the PowerPoint presentation. In addition to what you'll see on the slides during today's class, we have more information available in the notes section of the downloaded version. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. Moving to slide two, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and most often you're going to use that third button, the single right arrow. The slide number is listed in the upper left corner, and we're going to use that throughout today's training class. We're going to have question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end of the training. For our phone line participants, please leave your phone on mute until those question and answer breaks. Anyone is welcome to use the question mark button at the top of the slides to send in a question or a comment anytime throughout today's training, and we'll get to as many as we can during those question and answer breaks. On our last slide, we have a link to our feedback form, and even if you filled out feedback on part one and part two, we do want feedback for part three. Will you use the information you provide? You can also generate a certificate of participation for yourself through the feedback form, and that's the only way right now to get that certificate. So please complete the feedback form. At the end, there's a checkbox if you'd like to have a certificate. On slide three, more information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is led by state regulators and includes our federal partners, members from industry, as well as academia and community stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website to learn more about what other guidance documents are available and how you can become more involved in ITRC. On slide four, I'll introduce the trainers of today's class. Eric Gessert is the supervisor of the Petroleum Remediation Program for the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. He focuses on incorporating state-of-the-science technologies into the program, including advanced characterization techniques and conceptual site model developments. Ian Hers is a senior associate engineer with Golder Associates, located in Vancouver, British Columbia. He is a technical specialist in the areas of LNAPL and DNAPL source characterization, monitor natural attenuation, vapor intrusion, and vapor phase in-situ remediation technologies. Rick Ollers is a technical expert with Arcadis in San Diego, California. He has worked on sites ranging from service stations to refineries. On slide five, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Eric Gessert at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Eric?
All right. Thank you, Juliana. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. So as Juliana had indicated, this is the third part in a three-part series on internet-based training for LNAPL that the ITRC team has put together. So those first two presentations occurred over the past 2 weeks. We began by just identifying how LNAPL distributes through the subsurface, just a basic understanding of that. Part two largely focused on developing an LNAPL conceptual site model, which is, of course, a very critical factor in getting any of the cleanup approaches right. And so today's training is going to focus on what LNAPL remedial objectives are, an overview of some of the LNAPL remedial technologies, and then it's going to identify the remedial technology selection process that is lined out in the ITRC LNAPL technical and regulatory guidance. If we move on to slide six, this is sort of an overview slide of what the 2009 December 2009 guidance document entitled Evaluating LMAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. So this guidance document, it provides a really good framework for identifying what the concerns are with LMAPL, identifying what your cleanup objectives are, and then going through a selection process where there are 17 technologies that are presented in that guidance document, and the selection process helps for you to identify the best remedial technology based on what the concerns and objectives are that you've identified for your particular release. And, you know, we found that this guidance document is very beneficial for really any sized LMAPL release. Obviously, LMAPL sites can range from, you know, your corner store service station to, you know, a larger refining operation, which may be acres upon acres of cleanup that may need to occur. If we move to slide 7, the ITRC LMAPL team formed in 2007, and among the goals that that team had when you know, initially getting together, were really to identify objective-driven approaches to LMAPL issues. So you see that that's bullet point 2. It says, begin with the end in mind, you know, one of the habits of highly effective people, and really identifying those objective-driven, that objective-driven technology selection process was one of the goals that the group had. Another goal that the group had was addressing maximum extent practicable inconsistencies. As I'm sure you are aware, implementing agencies have to interpret from the Code of Federal Regulations what exactly the definition of maximum extent practicable is. And a lot of times those definitions weren't really objective driven. And then lastly, a large focus of the group when it originally formed was to just put forward the components of a good LMAPL conceptual site model. So if we move to slide 8, this is just sort of an overview of that team that that was originally put together to develop that guidance document and subsequently develop this internet-based training. It was a very collaborative process. It included state regulators. It included federal stakeholders, including the U.S. Army Corps, EPA, had academia representatives, and then it also had a large makeup of petroleum industry and environmental consulting experts. So it really was a diverse group that was able to look at the issue of LMAPL from different perspectives, which is always important when, you know, when we have a common goal, to make sure that the different perspectives are represented. Moving on to slide 9. So why is LMAPL important? Obviously, it was just identified that, you know, training on LMAPL was specifically needed. There are, of course, thousands of sites throughout the country where LMAPL is an issue. You know, I often say that every release that, you know, every LMAPL release that comes from a source point, it begins as LMAPL. It doesn't begin as a dissolve phase issue or as a vapor phase issue. It begins as LMAPL. Now, these LMAPL sites tended to have some, you know, regulatory complexities with different definitions of what endpoints needed to be. And there are, of course, technical complexities associated with LMAPL that has to do with the distribution of LMAPL, that we are getting better at understanding how exactly LMAPL does distribute itself through the subsurface. And then the LMAPL policies and regulations are frequently not science-based, feasible, beneficial, or practical. And so that was, again, one of the focuses of this group, was to come up with objective-based, you know, decision-making framework, as well as just presenting what is the state of the science as we understand LMAPL. Moving on to slide 10, so the LMAPL team that formed in 2007, as I mentioned, it had put out a couple technical guidance documents. One of them I already brought up, the Evaluating LMAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. Another technical guidance document that it put out in 2009 was evaluating natural source zone depletion at sites with elm apple. Of course, on top of those technical guidance documents, an internet-based training program was put together, which is obviously what you are a part of now. Hopefully you were able to be a part of all three of those. And then there has been ongoing classroom training, which began in 2011 and is continuing in 2016. As of right now, there is one date that has been identified in Atlanta, Georgia, in April of 2016, so more information can be found on the ITRC webpage for that. And I'm also happy to announce that an LMAPL update team was approved through ITRC this past year, and that team is just getting started. We are still in the process of accepting team members to, you know, to be a part of really incorporating what are new approaches, scientific thought that has been really developed over the past almost 10 years now, as well as incorporating some historic documentation on LMAPL. The goal of this group is to really put forth a web-based guidance that can sort of be a one-stop shop for LMAPL. So if there's any interest in being a part of that team, again, please just go to the ITRC webpage and you can find membership information there. So moving on to slide 11, the regulatory context of LMAPL. I've already spoken a bit about you know, the various definitions of maximum extent practicable, and frankly how a lot of those definitions, again, were not really objective-based. They, you know, common definitions include removing LMAPL observed in a monitoring well to a sheen, removing it to some defined thickness of an eighth of an inch, for example. Those were the type of sort of endpoints that had been identified in a lot of the states when this team got together. There was a state canvassing that was done, and, you know, we gathered the various definitions of what maximum extent practicable meant. I'm happy to say that, you know, through this training, or certainly as a part of this training, over 20 states have sort of adopted the risk-based and objective-driven approaches and technology selection framework that ITRC has put forth in that regulatory guidance document, as well as the classroom training and the internet-based training. So we're getting much more consistent in the terminology that we use and really using science-based decision-making to identify what the concerns are associated with LMAPL. Moving to slide 12, this is one of my sort of favorite concepts of LMAPL when we talk about concerns, is to really break them apart. You know, in my daily work life, when we have an LMAPL issue, I really, you know, talk with the consultants that I'm working with or the state regulators that I'm working with on, okay, well, what kind of concerns do we have with the LMAPL? And we've really tried to break those concerns out into two primary drivers. Drivers where you have compositional issues, where you may have the volatile fraction of LMAPL might be causing explosive hazard concerns. The soluble portion of the LMAPL body may be creating a dissolved phase plume that needs to be dealt with. And then you have the saturation-based concerns associated with LMAPL. Is it migrating? Does it have the potential to migrate to a surface water feature or get in direct contact with a basement? Things of that nature. When you have saturation-based issues, ultimately you are probably looking at some form of hydraulic recovery. And then, aside from having the, you know, the compositional concerns or the saturation-based concerns, you always have to keep in mind what is the regulatory body that I'm working with and how have they defined what the endpoints are that need to be achieved to address the LMAPL issue. So moving on to slide 13, this is sort of a funny slide. I'm pretty certain that it is intended to depict sort of how we did things in the past before we had more of an objective-driven approach to addressing LMAPL. where, you know, you see Alan Apple in a monitoring well, and it was often the case that, you know, almost immediately people would go out there and try to recover that Alan Apple from the well, see if it would come back. If it didn't come back, there would be a declaration that there is no more Alan Apple at the site. And if it did come back, there would be a concern that maybe there was an additional release that we were not aware of. But it wasn't real, you know, sort of science-driven as far as what are the endpoints of how we go about selecting a remedial technology. So if you move on to slide 14, this is actually a figure that is in that evaluating remedial technologies for Elm Apple. This is a figure in that document, and it kind of walks you through a bit better to identify an appropriate technology. So when you have Elm Apple at site, again, the first questions that you need to ask yourself are, do we have compositional concerns, or do we have saturation concerns, or potentially, do you have both of those? And then you can just sort of walk through this flow chart here, and if you need to address the Elm Apple directly, you can then go through the Elm Apple kind of selection process, which is identified in sections 6 through 8 of that guidance document. If you don't address the Elm Apple directly, let's say that you have some residual Elm Apple that is resulting in a dissolved phase plume, and that plume needs to be addressed, well then maybe you just go about addressing that dissolved phase plume and don't need to directly address the Elm Apple. But walking through a flowchart like this is something that can really help you in picking the right technology and really identifying what your objectives are. If we move on to slide 15, so overall, really what the document identifies, what that evaluating Elm Apple technology or evaluating Elm Apple remedial technologies for achieving project goals, we really wanted to promote principles that facilitate timely and successful Elm Apple remediation. And of course, that starts with characterization, developing a good conceptual site model. Once you have a good conceptual site model developed, we can really pinpoint what are the concerns associated with it. From there, we go about identifying, well, what are our cleanup objectives based off of those concerns, and what are our performance metrics that we're going to utilize to or not really performance metrics, I guess, but how are we going to evaluate when we've achieved our objective? And from there, you go about the technology selection process, and ultimately, we'll go into an implementation phase, but prior to that, it's, of course, important to identify what your performance metrics are. And this is essentially what is included in that technical guidance document. So if we go on to slide 16, this is a slide that has been included in some of the previous internet-based trainings on Elm Apple. But again, we talk about composition concerns. We talk about saturation concerns. This conceptual site model of a hypothetical Elm Apple plume, it sort of shows that you might have compositional concerns that are emergency vapor related. You might have compositional concerns that, again, are related to the soluble portion of the Elm Apple body. You might have compositional concerns that are associated with the volatile phase. You know, do you have petroleum vapor intrusion issues, for example? And then you might, of course, have saturation concerns. Again, do you have a potentially mobile Elm Apple body that could impact surface water features, go under houses, cross property boundaries, things of that nature? Or even, you know, it is possible to have a stated objective of removing saturation just based on the fact that that you have a saturational issue at your site. Moving on to slide 17. Again, in the training book and in the classroom training, we talk about mobile versus migrating versus residual Elm Apple. Starting at the bottom, where we're talking about residual Elm Apple, this is where The elm apple is, you know, it shares its pore space with both soil vapor and water, but when we have residual elm apple, there really isn't enough of a driving head for that elm apple to show up in monitoring wells or to migrate through the subsurface. So when you have residual elm apple concerns, and there are identifiers that have been previously covered to let you know if you may have residual elm apple concerns, but that's more of a compositional issue. Looking at the middle slide, we're talking about mobile elm apple conditions. So with mobile conditions, the elm apple has enough of a driving head to show up in a monitoring well, but it's really not migrating through the subsurface. It can appear in a monitoring well simply because of the fact that, you know, typically the filter packs associated with monitoring wells are less porous, and so there is not as much pore entry pressure that's needed by the elm apple to go into the monitoring well. Looking at the top one, migrating elm apple, this is where you have a larger percentage of elm apple saturation, and that elm apple does in fact have enough of a driving head that it is going to move through the subsurface. So it's important, again, just to sort of think of this slide when you identify elm apple in a well. You know, you of course should ask yourself the question, is it mobile or is it migrating? And again, we've already covered various ways to sort of, you know, try to make that distinction. And you sort of go on from there to start identifying what are your specific saturation or compositional concerns. Moving on to slide 18, this is some work that was done by Beckett and Huntley, and essentially it is the basis of the shark fin model, which has been presented again in the previous internet-based trainings. The historic and sort of wrong model of elm apple distribution is that it simply floats on top of the water table. We know based on the driving head of elm apple that based on its initial deposition into the subsurface that it can in fact penetrate below the water table, and it is never continuous. That is one of the bigger take-home points from this slide, is that elm apple saturation is never 100%. So if you look at the graph on the right, you're looking at elm apple saturation as a percent of pore space on the x-axis, and then on the y-axis you're looking at elm apple above the elm apple water interface. And essentially what this work found was that the highest percentage of elm apple saturation occurs slightly above the groundwater and elm apple interface, and it sort of reduces as it gets closer to that water interface. Capillary pressures are one of the sort of controlling factors associated with this distribution. But the data that was gathered by Beckett and Huntley largely led to the shark fin model, which is discussed and, you know, widely accepted in the elm apple community today. So if we move to slide 19, let's just sort of go over some example objectives. If you have a concern of mobility, well, then we're talking about a remedial objective where you have a saturation-based objective. And in the technical guidance document, and as will be discussed today, when we have saturation-based objectives, we're looking at technology groups that are in the grouping of either mass recovery or mass control. Moving on to slide 19, when we have composition-based objectives, we are more looking at technology groups that are in the phase change group. Your risk is largely viewed through you either have vapor issues or dissolve phased issues. So potential remedial solutions include changing the elm apple characteristics, having a cutoff treatment pathway, or simply reducing the elm apple mass. Moving on to slide 21. Let me make sure I didn't skip a slide. I'm sorry. Okay, moving on to slide 21. It's important to understand that as I'm sure people who have experience with, you know, cleanup, that this is an iterative process. We begin with characterization. We start to understand a bit better what is the problem that we're dealing with. That eventually leads us to developing a conceptual site model. That conceptual site model may tell us that we need to do additional characterization. And we sort of do that little iterative loop initially. Once we feel that we have a strong conceptual site model, we can start getting into the LMAPL management. What are the endpoints? What are the objectives that we're looking for? So that was just a basic overview of what has previously been covered. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Ian, and he is going to give an overview of some LMAPL remedial technologies.
Juliana?
Yes.
Juliana, can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Eric. We're going to now move on to the next part of the training. We're going to talk about remedial technologies, and we're going to present the different technologies that were reviewed in the ITRC guidance. We're also going to talk a little bit about some of the factors that affect remedial technology selection, and we're going to also cover some case studies. So just to let you know where we're at, we're on slide 23, and this is the introduction to the technology. So 17 different remedial technologies were addressed in the ITRC guidance, and we're going to begin with some of the basic mechanisms in ways in which these technologies work, and then we're going to move on to the framework for more detailed evaluation. And we're also going to go back to actually some of the key concepts addressed in parts one and two of the training and describe how they apply to technology selection or why they might be important to consider. So let's move on to slide 24. It's really important to understand the primary mechanism for each group of technologies. So within the 17 technologies, we divided them into four different groups based on LMAPL mass recovery, phase change remediation, shown on the next slide will be mass control, and then phase change remediation and mass recovery combined. So we're going to just touch on some of these briefly right now, and then we'll go into further detail in subsequent slides. But mass recovery is things like excavation, skimming, or dual pump liquid extraction, so actual physical removal of NAPL in the ground. Phase change remediation really is where we change the characteristics, or we take advantage of the properties of LMAPL, for example, volatilization. So that's a phase change from liquid to gas phase. Or it could be where we look at the partitioning of LMAPL into groundwater. And so some of the technologies listed there, we actually start with natural source zone depletion. Some of these things occur naturally. And again, we just want to refer you to the guidance that's being developed by ITRC. There's air sparging and solvapor extraction. And these are technologies actually that can also be used for mass recovery. So and they also, of course, promote phase change in that they will act on certain chemicals and at different rates. And so we can try to enhance that, and we'll have a really good example of that in subsequent slide. If we now move on to slide 25, mass control really just refers to physical containment through a wall or through a drain or possibly stabilization through in-situ slow mixing where we'll add a chemical, perhaps bentonite or some other cement-type chemical to stabilize the LMAPL in-situ. And then finally, phase change remediation and mass recovery are some technologies are surfactant-enhanced remediation, which I think we're seeing a little bit more use of in recent years. Also solvent or steam, hot air injection. And here we're trying to enhance the phase change, we're trying to perhaps reduce the amount of residual NAPL or the saturation point and therefore promote actual physical removal through pumping. And so these are technologies that you might consider for more aggressive remediation. Often at sites, we consider a treatment train approach where we'll start with actual physical removal of NAPL through, for example, a dual pump liquid extraction, or could be a skimming system. We then may move on to asparging or SVE for additional mass recovery, but also phase change remediation. And then finally, as a polishing step, maybe natural source zone depletion. So it's important to understand the objectives and the mechanisms and ways in which technologies work. So that's a key point from these slides. If we now move on to slide 26, here we're looking at the linkage between some of the concepts that Eric presented and the different technology classes or mechanisms. So saturation objective. Here we're looking at mass recovery. We'll reduce L-NAPL saturation by recovering and removing L-NAPL mass. If our objective is a compositional one, here we'll look more at phase change remediation. And then finally, if our objective is just to contain the NAPL, perhaps it's migrating, there's a concern there, then we look at L-NAPL mass control. If we now move on to slide 27, here's where we're, one of the slides where we're going to go back to part one of the training. And it's just a reminder with respect to when you have mobile NAPL that may be potentially recoverable, may also be potentially migrating. And here is the classic shark fin profile shown as saturation versus the vertical dimension or the L-NAPL thickness in the sole column. We have a residual saturation line, often variable or varying depending on depth. And here, really the objective of this slide is to point out again is that the mobile NAPL, which is potentially recoverable, is where the saturation exceeds residual saturation. So it's important to have a good conceptual site model, perhaps some tests, laboratory tests of saturation, or a predictive model based on L-NAPL thickness in the well. Of course, we pointed out some of the potential issues with that in the first part of the training. Again, it is important to try to understand the mobile NAPL present before you start thinking about designing a L-NAPL recovery system, and that may influence your technology selection. Slide 28 really just goes a little bit further with the part one concepts, and it shows two figures here. The one on the left is the relative permeability versus the NAPL saturation, and it just shows the contrasting relationships for NAPL versus water. For NAPL, the relative permeability increases as the saturation increases. And that's an important consideration for looking at perhaps a remedial technology that really aims to optimize or enhance L-NAPL recovery to a well. At that point, you may consider estimating the relative permeability, trying to understand the flow rate of NAPL to a well. The figure on the right really just brings us back to the overall conceptual site model for L-NAPL bodies, where if we look at the core of the L-NAPL body, there's where we typically have the higher saturations, the greater thicknesses in the well, and the higher heads, and where we have greater potential for remedial success in terms of pumping L-NAPL out of a well. If we look at the fringes of that L-NAPL body, there is where the thicknesses tend to be smaller, the saturations are lower, and where the L-NAPL head is less than the pore entry pressure. And consequently, we often have stable L-NAPL bodies. So again, this kind of gives us a better conceptual site model and also helps us in our remedial selection. We now move on to slide 29. Here we're illustrating the result of soil vapor extraction, where a compositional objective is primarily illustrated. This is some great field data. This site, the SVE, was effective for removing the lighter molecular volatile hydrocarbons and achieving a compositional objective. This is shown through the time series analysis of TPH over 4 years, where you see very clearly the shift in the composition from light end in 2005 to a heavier end in 2009. The actual mass also decreases, so in this case, SVE was successful in reducing some of the mass. We've also seen this at a site we recently investigated, not shown here, but where SVE was successful in reducing the benzene concentrations in groundwater substantially. And there were lesser decreases in some of the heavier molecular weight compounds like xylene. So it was, again, an example. If that's your objective, to perhaps reduce benzene concentrations, then you can exploit the characteristics of the fuel, the composition, to achieve that objective. Slide 30 is really just a summary slide that conceptually describes the concept I was just referring to. It's a sort of an analysis or illustration of what happens if you reduce the saturation, if you go from A to B, shown on the right there, where compared to going from A to C, where you change the composition. And if you, for example, reduce the saturation by about half, you go from A to B, the benzene concentration in groundwater stays about the same. Again, this is conceptual, but this illustrates that if you still have a significant amount of mass remaining and you don't change the composition, then the concentration will not change. You really need to start to remove a very significant proportion of the mass that's there, perhaps over 90%, till you start to see a decline in benzene concentrations. In contrast, if you change the composition and the mole fraction such that the benzene mole fraction decreases, then you also decrease the concentration of benzene in groundwater. So that's the key point here again, is just conceptually to show how the difference in mass recovery or Kalnapple saturation versus composition. If we now move on to...
I'm sorry, we're picking up some background noise. So if you are having a discussion at your location, somebody just came in your office, please be sure that your phone is muted. You actually are picking up quite a bit of background noise from your location. So be sure that your phone is muted. Sorry about that, Ian. You can go ahead.
Okay. Thanks, Juliana. We're on slide 31. We're now moving on to the summary characteristics of remedial technologies. This is table 5.2 in the guidance. So all 17 technologies are summarized with respect to the pros and cons, the geology, the objective, and the time frames. It's a really helpful summary table. I don't think there are other guidance documents that really provide this type of information, so it gives you a way to start comparing different technologies. They all act differently depending on the LNAPL properties and site conditions, and technologies in many cases exploit particular characteristics of LNAPL, such as saturation or volatility. So it is important to understand this, and that's certainly part of the technology selection process. Now move on to slide 32. This slide is a little bit of a departure, actually, from the overall guidance, but I think it's a really important reminder. So before we start diving into different considerations for technologies, it's just a step back and realize that the LNAPL conceptual site model is really important, and beyond just site and LNAPL conditions shown there in the largest circle, there are other factors. This could be everything from cost, access, liability concerns, perhaps time frames for remediation. And then there's testing and modeling. The process is really important, and we don't discuss that in this training to a great extent, but things like pilot testing, modeling, particularly for larger complex sites, can be really helpful. So we just wanted to provide a reminder of that, that process in this slide. So moving on to slide 33. Now we're going to just briefly go over the key considerations that were back in Table 5.2. So there are site conditions, things like grain size, depth, the difference between the unsaturated and saturated zone, and that can be very important for some technologies. And then the LNAPL conditions, everything from saturation to composition and volatility. The viscosity is important depending on your fuel type or product in the ground. Just a very simple example to start with. Certain technologies will not be feasible or less effective at larger depths, so multi-phase extraction, particularly if you're using kind of a slurping type remediation, and that may not be effective at larger depths. An example of how LNAPL could affect remediation, pumping rates will be slower for more viscous products, and so viscosity is just a basic property that's really important. So let's go through some slides where we're going to look at this framework in the context of a few case studies. The first one is one that probably many of you are familiar with. It's excavation. It's a technology. It's used, in, of course, in many sites. Here is a case study that I would just like to describe. It's the site that we worked on and where initial investigation indicated certain distribution to LNAPL soil contamination. An excavation plan was put in place and excavation started. At the water table, there was still contamination. It was determined that it extended deeper, and also the extent of contamination laterally was greater than anticipated. Not an uncommon story, but it really points to the importance of understanding your LNAPL distribution here. I think the head was sufficient that it pushed LNAPL deeper below the water table, and fortunately at this site there was access, there was the ability to remove water from the excavation and continue to excavate. So again, important to understand your conceptual site model. A good site investigation is key. Well, just some really simple observations on excavation. It's the short time frames, complete LNAPL removal potentially is possible. The disadvantages include things like access, possibly dewatering, and then sustainability is, I think, a broader issue that could be a consideration. For example, if you're digging large volumes of soil and trucking, you may have safety, greenhouse gas emissions, things like that that might be important to consider. The next technology shown in slide 35 is natural source zone depletion. And that really looks at phase change and also biodegradation. So the processes that can occur are volatilization and biodegradation, dissolution in the saturated zone. Really, this is a process that is low intensity. It takes place over decades. The advantages are that there is really, it's not intrusive. It's relying or taking advantage of natural processes. Perhaps it's a low carbon footprint, sustainable. Monitoring probably would be a consideration there, but certainly you don't have large volumes of soil or products that need to be treated. The disadvantages are long time frames. The interesting thing is that there is research that's just been done in the last year or two that is starting to give us a better idea of rates, and we're seeing that in some cases the natural attenuation or decline in concentrations related to fuels is significant over decades. So it's certainly not a process that takes a few years. It's going to take time, but I think we're going to develop a better understanding of natural source zone depletion and possibly a combined approach where there is some partial remediation or removal of hot spots combined with natural source zone depletion, which could potentially achieve objectives at sites. Now moving on to slide 36 is a variable wall example. This is mass control. So this is a site example of a low permeability soil bentonite wall to prevent the off-site movement of NAPL. And my understanding was that there was a receptor nearby, so that was an important objective. The photo on the right shows the trench under construction, involves excavation and filling the trench with a slurry to keep that trench open. It was constructed to between 20 and 30 feet depth, and it was keyed into a confining layer. Sometimes for LNAPL sites, a hanging wall may be a reasonable or appropriate solution. So in this case, it was keyed into an aquitard. There are examples of barrier walls being constructed to significantly greater depths, perhaps 100 feet. There's cutter mixing technologies, some new technologies that allow for that. The advantages of this technology is that it can provide for effective control of NAPL and actually dissolve plume mobility. The disadvantage, one of them is that to prevent overtopping and rise of your water table, you will need a pumping, groundwater pumping system in combination with the barrier wall. And that LNAPL is not treated, so it's certainly it's a long-term solution, management option. And the construction of barrier walls could also be relatively costly depending on your site. We move on now to slide 37. We're going to start looking at some phase change technologies, and we start with air sparging and soil vapor extraction. Air sparging is where air is injected, or there's certainly other variants of that, things like ozone, or but the simple kind of technology application, air is injected. There is a volatilization, of course, also biodegradation is enhanced, and soil vapor extraction just is the technology where in the unsaturated zone you're removing air or soil gas from a well. And again, there is biodegradation that occurs. The bioventing is kind of the complementary technology. Bioventing, though, can be implemented differently where you actually blow air into the formation at a lower flow rate. So the advantage of this technology is the potential for changing composition. There may also be some mass removal that can be achieved, certainly through physical stripping, but also through biodegradation. Some of the key conditions, if we look at that, are obviously grain size and permeability. Have faster air flow rates in higher permeability soils, greater mass removal rates, or greater mass change rates in terms of composition. Some key LNAPL conditions are the volatility. This technology, in terms of the soil vapor extraction, is really targeted towards relatively volatile products such as gasoline. So when there are significant quantities of free NAPL, LNAPL in wells, and so there's a lot of mobile LNAPL present at a site, I think one of the cautions is that soil vapor extraction would not be the first technology you would be considering, or air sparging. It would be important to look at mass removal through, for example, a pumping technology, a hydraulic removal technology, which we'll get into in a moment. Slide 38 is an example of some modeling that we did on a site where we were looking at optimizing the soil vapor extraction system for a site with extensive BTEX contamination. The depth to the water table was about 3.5 meters. The contamination was down around 2.5 to 3.5, at least the primary area of NAPL. And we looked at optimizing SVE through the use of a model called Airflow SVE. One of the things that it allowed us to do was to evaluate the airflow vectors, which are shown on the left figure, and then also the predicted vapor concentrations over time shown on the right figure, and also simulate the effect of barriers placed at surface, which could just be, for example, a geomembrane, and that would promote the enhanced radius of influence for airflow. So at this site, the key point, what we were able to kind of show and understand through this is that the rate of soil gas pore flushings was the key factor for remedial success. And as you can see, there is a lot of pore flushings, higher airflow rates, right near the well, compared to as you move away from the well. So that's kind of an obvious result, but it allowed us to predict how fast we'd remove NAFL and also help us optimize the spacing of wells at this site. If we now move on to slide 39, here's where we're going to start talking about hydraulic recovery. So this is mass recovery. And some of the key conditions are the grain size distribution and permeability and depth. The LNAFL conditions, I think the two key ones are saturation and viscosity. The technologies that can be applied here are really span a whole range of technologies, everything from skimmers to balers to pneumatic recovery systems, pumping, single pump systems, to multi-phase extraction where you may remove both groundwater and product. There's certainly a lot we could describe and go over. Just for sake of time, we won't. But just some of the general observations I have, worked with a whole range of systems, is that, of course, skimmers and balers are low cost. The radius of influence is small. Typically, the amount of product that can be removed is quite small. If you have a site with a lot of mobile NAFL, that's where you may consider multi-phase extraction or more aggressive technologies. The sort of disadvantages with some of these technologies are that once you start removing different liquids, groundwater and product, you have treatment considerations. You may have emissions with respect to volatiles. And consequently, the cost can be relatively high. And so there are kind of sustainability questions and cost considerations. So it's around the residuals management. And so that certainly is a balance. And I think Rick will kind of talk about some of the different technology considerations in his section of the presentation. I mentioned that the amount of mobile NAFL is critical, and we're on slide 40, where this is a summary from our part one training, and it really is simply to ask the question, how much mobile NAFL do you have present? This slide showed the difference in the amount of mobile NAFL, depending on the soil type, where we have the highest amount for gravel and the lowest amount for silt, as you can imagine. Of course, we don't use the pancake model. So the appropriate conceptualization is absolutely key. And then there are models that can be applied based on the vertical equilibrium model, based on thicknesses in wells. And again, it's an option for you to look at. There are models by API called the LDRM model that would allow you to quantify this and predict the amount of NAFL. The reason we sort of point this out is that if you're looking at a range of technologies that were just described in the previous slide, everything from baling and skimming to much more aggressive and costly systems, it is really important to understand how much NAFL you have in the subsurface. Certainly there have been sites where systems have been installed with very little product removed, and that's something we like to try to avoid. If we now move on to slide 43, this is a review of again, part one. It shows on the left the height relative to groundwater, and on the right the LNAFL saturation, and it shows an LIF profile, the laser-induced fluorescence. And it also shows a model called the API model, that's just based on the vertical equilibrium. The point here is that there's a lot of variability. LIF is actually, I think, is a great tool to better understand your LNAPL distribution in the subsurface. Shown on the right is the LNAPL saturation for a site with actual measurement data from different soil cores that were analyzed. And it shows an attempt to come up with a better predictive model based on layering. That could be important at some sites. If you are going to go down the modeling road, is to understand the variability and to more accurately predict what's there. And again, that could feed into the evaluation of your LNAPL recovery and technology selection. So again, we wanted to point out the realism of real world sites and the variability that you could encounter. If we now move on to slide 42, we're going to talk just a little bit about phase or mass recovery and phase change. This is where it involves typically a combination of hydraulic pumping and conditions that change the nature of the LNAPL. So this could be an oxidizer, heat, surfactant, or solvents. So if we're using a surfactant, the objective is to reduce the residual saturation and therefore increase the LNAPL that can be pumped, the LNAPL mass that could be removed. We also may exploit some other things with that in terms of biodegradation. There's a range of different ways that you can try to change the properties of LNAPL and enhance recovery. Obviously, if you're dealing with heat or steam, then it's volatilization that we're looking at. So the advantage is increased mass recovery. The disadvantage are the higher potential costs. The energy inputs can be significant. The advantages, again, could be faster time frames for remediation. Greater certainty in achieving perhaps a numerical standard for your site. We don't see, I think, a lot of sites where these technologies are applied, and not to say that they're not perhaps worth considering, but often there are some questions about the certainty in achieving remedial objectives and also just simply the cost and sustainability of these approaches. So certainly I think it is exciting that some new technologies are out there, but probably we need a little bit better understanding of their effectiveness, and so hopefully we'll see that over the coming years. If we move on to slide, 43, here is an example of six-phase heating. This actually is a technology that's pretty well understood. It's been used for quite some time, and I first of all want to say it's electrical resistance heating. Six phases is one of the ways it's implemented. It can be three phase. Applies electricity to the ground through electrodes, which raise the temperature of the boiling point of water. The middle array is for six phase heating at least, is the vapor extraction well. So obviously very important to remove volatilized constituents. This slide here shows a photograph of a configuration of electrodes, vapor lines. It was a fuel release that was remediated through six-phase heating. There was some really interesting modeling done with a model called CompFlow that looked at the heat that would be created, the temperature in the subsurface. So there were plans shown there in a cross-section, section BB and AA. Helped better understand the potential for success for this remediation. So the key LNAPL conditions are the saturation and the composition, particularly the volatility of the contamination. This will affect the rate at which they are removed. So again, the advantage, enhanced recovery, possibly faster time frames, some disadvantages, greater complexity, higher energy costs, and you have residuals management. Another potential concern is a geotech concern or structural concern with drying of soils and potential settlements is something to keep in mind. Moving on, we're now at slide 44. We're approaching the last two slides, and here is a summary that is from actually some work done by Sanjay Garg of Shell as part of the guidance. And it really conceptually looks at the effects of partial mass recovery on LNAPL concentrations. And so here we have a hypothetical case where we start with the base case A. We can look at 50% NAPL reduction vertically. Perhaps there was some dewatering or some excavation that allowed that, or perhaps soil vapor extraction that removed sort of the top part of the contamination. And just based on a mixing concept that reduces your relative concentration by half, but it doesn't change the timelines for remediation. Keep in mind, this is conceptual. If we now move on to case C, we have 50% LNAPL reduction in the direction of flow, but we're not changing anything in that half of the unremediated area. And so consequently what happens is the concentration doesn't change. The assumption is that flowing groundwater will come in contact with NAPL and come to equilibrium in sufficient time. But if there is a dissolution model, so NAPL is being continually removed by flowing groundwater, the concept is that the time decreases by half. And then finally, if we look at a 20% reduction in the LNAPL saturation, here's where we don't change the relative concentration, but the relative time is 0.8, or reduction of 20%. I think these are helpful conceptually. They may guide you in sort of trying to understand how NAPL changes over time, and there are also some more quantitative models that can be applied. One of them is by API called LMAST, and another model called RemFuel might give you an idea of how long LNAPL sources will remain in the ground, particularly important for, I think, under a natural source zone depletion framework. So I think we're on just the last slide here, and so we talked about the technology description and the primary mechanisms. Really important to know whether we're looking at mass removal, phase change, control, or combination of those. We looked at the composition versus saturation, and we looked at the summary characteristics of the remedial technologies. So the different LNAPL conditions, things like viscosity, saturation, volatility, interfacial tension, versus site conditions, everything from grain size, permeability, depth, and so forth. And that's integrated in Table 5.2, and then we looked at how those apply for different technologies that were reviewed. And really, we just provided some case examples to give you an introduction. So with that, I'm going to pass it back to Juliana. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. We are going to take a very short break now for questions. So everyone is welcome to use that orange question mark at the top of the slide. Phone line audience, you're welcome to unmute, pound 6 to unmute, and you can ask questions out loud. I'll also remind you at this point, we do look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. So if you need to leave before we wrap up, you can use that fourth button to fast forward to the last slide. That's going to take you to a place where you can follow the link to the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. You also have the ability to get a certificate of participation from today's training. So filling out the feedback at the bottom of that form, there's a place where you can check and get that certificate. Right now, that's the only way to get the certificate. So if you do forget to check that box the first time, just go ahead, go back in the feedback, fill it out again, and check that box at the end. I don't have another way of getting you a certificate. So it's just through that feedback that you can get the certificate. So everyone is welcome to send in questions using that orange question mark button. You can send those in any time throughout the training class today. For the phone line audience, now is the time you can unmute and ask some questions out loud. Do we have any questions to start from the phone line audience?
Yeah, I have a question on slide 27.
Okay. Yes, and for our audience, remember you can jump back on the left to slide 27.
Yeah, What's the difference between what's on the y-axis and depth? Is it the same thing as depth?
Yeah, the y-axis is depth. So in concept, we're looking at a vertical profile, and the typical distribution of LNAP will we see at the water table. And so that's where you see that kind of shark fin profile for LNAP saturation.
About where would the water table be?
Roughly where that arrow is shown in both directions there, that would be roughly where it is, yeah.
The blue arrow?
Yeah, that's correct.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
From the simulcast, if you install a barrier wall, is there any concern that a saturated LNAP will migrate vertically along the wall?
LNAP is, if it's lighter than water, I'm not sure how vertically it could move. The one point I'd make about that, if there is considerable mobile LNAP in the formation, I think that you would want to have some mechanism, be it a drain with sumps or pumping wells, that would remove mobile LNAP. The barrier wall is certainly designed to prevent the movement, but if you have, you know, a buildup of significant quantity of that LNAP, you'd want to remove that.
Our next simulcast question refers to slide 29. So again, along the left, you can jump back. On slide 29, why were concentrations of heavier end components, C13 through 17, increasing with time?
Wow, that's a good observation and point there. So I think
you don't need to jump in on this.
Rick, you want to jump in? Okay.
Well, yeah, it is my data. Two explanations. One is that you're just looking at heterogeneity there. Necessarily, those were three different sampling boreholes, so the saturations probably varied a little bit between those locations, even though we tried to keep them about 5 feet apart from each other. Another explanation that's been pointed out to me is that as you do SVE, the biodegradation that's induced does convert some of these hydrocarbons to a partial degradation product, which actually appears later in the laboratory data when you do the elution. So they're polar compounds. They don't come out of the sample as quickly, and it looks like they're heavier. So that could be another explanation for why you see that shift to the slightly heavier compounds.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap this question and answer break up. We hope to have time at the end to ask more questions, so you are welcome to send in those questions using that orange question mark button. If you're in the phone line, remember #6 to go off of mute, and so *6 to go back on mute. So if you did take your phone off of mute, either mute at your location or *6 to mute back in our system. We'll continue on with the second half of the training class, and on slide 47, I'm going to turn it over to Rick Ahlers at Arcadis. Rick?
All right. Thanks, Juliana. And unfortunately, Eric had an emergency at his location, so I'm going to jump in and do the next 9 slides of his, and hopefully my take will be what his is, but I apologize in advance if I don't cover everything he wanted to. So on slide 48, you can see, you want to reiterate the LNAP concerns that may be present at a site. So we can see things like, number one, where vapors might be accumulating in a utility or a confined space, and they might exceed explosive levels. So that would be a very immediate concern, which you really want to jump in and address right away. Less urgent concerns are going to be things like 3A and 3B and 2, where we have the composition of the NAPL driving vapor concerns or groundwater concerns. And finally, concerns around the LNAPL body itself, like 5, where you have LNAPL accumulating in monitoring wells, or 4, where the LNAPL may be migrating and that LNAPL body may be continuing to expand. So you want to think about what are your concerns at your site, because that's going to help you start to think about what your objectives are and how to achieve those objectives. So in exactly that on slide 49, so if you understand what your concern is, you can start to understand what your remedial objective is. Do you have a composition objective? Do you have a saturation objective? And that's going to drive you down the road to whether you want to use a phase change technology or a mass recovery or mass control technology like Ian was just talking about. And the key point here is you want to select the right tool to do the job you want to do, to achieve your objectives. On slide 50, some of the key terms and concepts as we're starting to develop this framework for selecting remedial technology. We want to talk about the LNAPL remedial objective, and that is what you want to do to mitigate that LNAPL concern you've identified. So that's the overall arching objective for the site. Then we drill down a little bit to what we want to call a remediation goal, and that's that objective that's stated more in the context of a remedial technology. And it's, if you're using one remediation technology to achieve your objective, it might just be a more specific statement of that objective, but maybe you're going to use a treatment train, and you might have multiple goals along the way to that objective. So you want to understand what your goal is for the type of technology that you're using. And then finally, performance metrics, and these are really important, because they're going to tell you when your technology has gotten to the goal. You want to think about what type of measurements you can do during implementation of remediation to show you're making progress toward the goal and understand when you've met that goal and when it's time to turn off that technology, when that technology is no longer effective. And either you've achieved your objective or you need to move on to another technology that's going to get you to your objective. So on slide 51, these are some example remediation objectives, remedial objectives. We have risk-based objectives, and I think about, you know, human health risk-based objectives or the environment. You want to reduce concentrations below a certain risk level or a hazard level. You might want to cut off an exposure pathway. Then there are non-risk objectives, and a lot of these are related to the LNAPL itself and whether the LNAPL is mobile, if the LNAPL body can continue to migrate and expand, perhaps contaminate some more soil. If we want to reduce the thickness of LNAPL in wells, or more importantly, as we've talked about on a few of the previous presentations, the LNAPL transmissivity. Let's reduce the mobility of the LNAPL to a de minimis level. Or there may be a corporate policy about liability and risk tolerance that relates directly to how much NAPL can be present at the site or whether NAPL can be present in wells. And then finally, there's the ever-present regulatory driver that we need to recover NAPL to the maximum extent practical, and that's interpreted differently in different states. So again, what we're doing here is we're linking remedial strategies back to the initial concerns and the objectives that we've identified to mitigate those concerns. So then on slide 52, again, some more key terms and concepts, and let's have a couple of examples of what a remedial objective is. So in the first case, LNAPL is present in a well, and that's the concern. We don't want LNAPL present in that well. So the objective is to recover LNAPL mass to the extent practical. However, if LNAPL is the source of a dissolved phase plume, and that's your concern, then the objective is going to be to reduce the soluble fraction in the LNAPL in order to meet the groundwater quality standards. So, you know, that's going to be more of a phase change as opposed to that mass recovery in the first example. In the third example, LNAPL is generating explosive conditions in a utility. Long term, the objective is going to be to reduce the volatile L-NAPL fraction and reduce that fraction of the L-NAPL that might be generating methane through biodegradation, and have that eliminate the long-term threat of explosive vapor accumulations in a utility or confined space. Now, short-term, you want to be very careful and make sure that you're addressing the risks of that vapor accumulation, and that's usually done through administrative controls, like keeping people out of that utility or ventilating that utility, some sort of an engineering control. On slide 53, now we're going to go from the objective, and in this case we'll talk about the objective of recovering L-NAPL to the extent practical, and we'll step down to the specific goal level. So in the first example, the goal we're going to have is removing L-NAPL just to the residual saturation, and we're going to call that the extent practical. And so you can see that that links to a technology like dual-phase L-NAPL recovery. So that's a technology that's going to get us toward that residual saturation. However, if we want to instead have a goal of complete L-NAPL removal, a technology like dual-phase L-NAPL recovery is not going to work. We'll need to do something like excavation of L-NAPL-impacted soil. So you can see how those two different goals affect what technology you're going to select and how they address the overall objective slightly differently. On slide 54, we look at performance metrics. So again, we're looking at an example goal in this case of L-NAPL approaching residual saturation, and what sort of performance metrics can we use to evaluate how our remedial system is doing and when it's reached that goal. We can look at things like L-NAPL transmissivity. How mobile is the L-NAPL? Is it possible that by continued pumping we're going to remove a significant fraction, additional fraction of the L-NAPL? And that's when we get down to this 0.1 to 0.8 square foot per day transmissivity metric. Another endpoint might be we just stabilized dissolved plume condition concentrations, and that's an indicator of how stable the L-NAPL body is overall. Or we can start to look at things like if we're using a dual phase or dual pump recovery system, how much water are we having to pump to get out a gallon of L-NAPL? In this case, we might go say that when that ratio is 250:1, that the system has run to its effective endpoint. We can also look at how much it costs to remove a gallon of L-NAPL. You know, there are O&M costs to running these systems and monitoring these systems. Maybe if you get to $100 for every gallon of L-NAPL removed by your hydraulic recovery system, that's a good endpoint. And finally, if one of the goals we have is keeping that L-NAPL in place, then we can look at where the center of mass of the L-NAPL is. And if that center of mass isn't moving, then that may be a good endpoint for our L-NAPL recovery system. On slide 55, just going to summarize what this is, the importance of thinking about what your concerns are, what objectives you have to mitigate those concerns, what goals you want to use for your remediation system, and then the metrics you use to measure your progress toward those goals. It all comes together to get you to from a point where you have a concern to a point where you don't have a concern anymore, where you've mitigated that concern. And you know, if you shortchange yourself, you're either going to fail at your attempt because you didn't adequately link your concerns to your remedial objectives and goals, or you're going to be remediating for much longer than necessary because you're failing to set reasonable goals or to measure your progress toward those goals adequately so that you understand when you've gotten to an endpoint rather than just continuing to run a system. So now on slide 56, we're going to take the next section. We're going to take all of these concepts we've been discussing today, and we're going to put them in a framework that's presented in our guidance document for how to step through all of these concepts to get to the end and select a remedial technology that's going to work for your site. So on slide 57, this is a flowchart I'm going to use throughout the rest of the presentation to remind everyone where we are in the guidance document. You can find this flowchart on figure 5.1 in the guidance document. So the information outlined in blue, in the blue boxes, has already been covered mainly in the Internet-based training part 2, but also earlier in today's training. And that information is going to set the stage for the selection of the remedial technologies. The next two steps, the next two boxes, sorry, show the first steps in the selection process. They are probably the most important steps. Selecting a technology group based on the objectives and goals, like I was just talking about, and then screening those technologies against site-specific geological factors. The picture on the lower right is a hole that was found in the bottom of an above-ground storage tank during regular turnaround. And, you know, this is the type of this is the type of situation that drives these LMAPL concerns and LMAPL cleanup goals. On slide 58, the next section in the LMAPL guidance document, section 7, covers additional evaluation factors to be considered when screening remedial technologies. Sometimes these evaluation factors are referred to as balancing factors in feasibility studies. So you may have heard about them that way before. Then the next section, section 8, covers the testing and data collection that may be necessary for final remedy selection or remedy design. And then the last three boxes cover the key step when you're implementing a remedial technology, when to stop remediation or application of a particular technology. So again, like I was saying before, when you're by establishing remedial goals and metrics for a technology and then monitoring the remedial performance, you can demonstrate when the goals have been met and be able to shut off that particular remediation system and then evaluate whether you have mitigated your overall concerns. Finally, on slide 59, I just want to take an aside for a minute that what we're focusing on here in this guidance document is selection of an active technology, an active remediation technology. You may have an LMAPL site that has no overarching concerns, and passive LMAPL management is an acceptable method. You're not going to get you're not going to get to that endpoint by following this this selection process, this technology evaluation process. You need to make that decision outside this framework. The other point I'll make is that at any step in this process, you may need additional data or in order to further evaluate objectives or goals, concerns, or tell the difference between how two technologies are going to perform. So as you're going through the process, think about the data that you need, the data that you have, and whether you need more data. If you're developing more data as you're going through the process, how does it affect your identification of concerns and objectives? On slide 60. So now we'll start talking about the process. So the first step is screening the remedial technologies for your site, section 6. We're going to start with the 17 technologies described in the guidance document. And in this first step, our goal is to get down to 5 or so of these technologies that might work at your site. So it's a two-step process here. In the first step, we're going to look at those remedial objectives, goals, and metrics, and then screen the technologies according to some basic site conditions. In step 2 of the process, we take those technologies that we've screened in, and do a more careful evaluation of the technologies against the site-specific geologic factors. And that's, we'll use the A-series tables in Appendix A of the guidance document. So this whole process, this whole part of the process here is really looking at the effectiveness of remedial technologies to be able to mitigate your concerns and achieve the remedial objectives you've identified. So on slide 61, we'll start here in table 6-1. I've taken one of the rows out of table 6-1 in order to be able to show you what's going on and read it. Table 6-1 is 3 pages long. There's a lot of information there. You can spend a lot of time just reading through that table and getting some good information. So on this slide and the next 4 slides, we'll go through table 6-1 in detail. You're going to work this table from left to right, starting with your remedial objectives. And what we have is the remedial objectives in the first column here. In this example row, we've got reducing the LNAPL saturation when it's above the residual range. But we might want to reduce it further than that. We might want to have an objective of terminating LNAPL body expansion, which is less aggressive than getting LNAPL down to the residual range. Or we might have composition-based objectives, like abating toxic or vapor accumulations or dissolved phase concentrations. There might also be aesthetic concerns related to saturation or composition objectives. And you can see over here, in the bottom right, there's a picture of a skimmer system. And that skimmer system is going to be effective for addressing concerns like reducing the LNAPL mass and mobility or reducing an aesthetic concern related to saturation. On slide 62, now we're going to step and link this to the LNAPL remedial goal. So in this case, we're going to reduce LNAPL to the extent practicable. Other goals are abating LNAPL body expansion or abating toxic vapors. These are more specific statements, again, of that objective. In the bottom right, what we see here is a sand tank experiment from Colorado State University. There's LNAPL in a well and also in the formation, which is simulated by the glass beads next to that well. And you can see in the upper part of that image, the brighter red in the formation is mobile LNAPL. But then lower down, there's a very light pink, and that's immobile LNAPL, residual LNAPL. So if we're recovering LNAPL from that well, we're going to be able to take some of the LNAPL out of the mobile portion in the formation, but we're not going to address the LNAPL that's in the immobile part of the formation. And that immobile LNAPL there and any residual LNAPL that's left after we can recover the recoverable fraction in the mobile portion, that will continue to drive a dissolved phase concern. On slide 63, then we identify the technology group in the third column of table 6-1, and this is, you know, the three groups we've been talking about: mass recovery, mass control, and composition change. In the graphic on the lower right, we've got two of those technology groups in action. There's the sheet pile wall there next to the river, which is a barrier to LNAPL migration and LNAPL seepage into that river. And then behind that, in the plastic sheds, are LNAPL skimmer systems. And so there's mass recovery going on. We talked about that in response to the question just a few minutes ago. You have LNAPL accumulating behind this barrier wall, so you need to recover it and keep the mobility down. On slide 64, example performance metrics. We're looking at, in this case, asymptotic performance of the recovery system. So you can see in the example graphic there that the green line, with time, that LNAPL recovery rate is going to go down to some very low level and really not change very much. So you can see initially the recovery rate was very high, and over the first year it declined, and after about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, you get down to this asymptotic point of recovery. As we said before, we can look at water-oil ratio, dollars per gallon of LNAPL removed, pounds of carbon dioxide generated per gallon of LNAPL removed. You can see on the red line that the 10-year cost per gallon, as you get to the later time of the operation of the system, your O&M costs haven't changed, but you're not recovering as much NATBOL. So the cost per gallon is going to go up. And then on slide 65, we come to the technologies that are going to be screened in for that particular set of objectives, goals, groups, and metrics. Next to each of these technologies that's listed that might be able to address your objective, there are some superscripts. And those superscripts relate to the LNAPL type that's at your site and the geologic, some basic geologic indicators about your site. So in this case, you can see we've got a picture here of LNAPL halos around small pores in clay. So, you know, a fine-grained site is going to be a site where you really have to think hard about how to do the LNAPL recovery because it's quite low permeability. It's going to be quite challenging to recover LNAPL. So you'll notice that in the LNAPL technologies that are listed there, there isn't an F listed for any one of those three technologies. And what that means is that we don't think those technologies are particularly well-suited to use in fine-grained soils, to use to recover LNAPL from fine-grained soils. On slide 66, we're going to go to step two of the first part of the screening process, and that's where we're going to look at more site-specific geologic factors and how they will influence the effectiveness of those remedial technologies that we've screened in so far. On slide 67, here's an example page for skimming from the A-series tables in Appendix A in the back of the guidance document. The red box I've blown up above so we can read it better. And this is just looking at the effect of permeability, the formation permeability, on the effectiveness of skimming. So when permeability is higher, we're going to be able to accomplish more LNAPL saturation reduction with skimming and accomplish it more quickly. As those permeabilities are reduced, the effectiveness of skimming becomes less and less. So you'll want to use that and look at the other technologies that have been screened in and evaluate which ones are potentially effective for your site and which ones should be ruled out at that point, screened out, based on, again, those site-specific geologic factors. So then we get to Section 7 on slide 68, and we've got... hopefully we've gone from 17 technologies down to 5, 4, something in that range, based on how we understand our concerns, objectives, goals. If you get to Section 7 and you don't have more than one technology left, we can go to slide 69. If you get to that point, you need to go back and reevaluate what the goals are for the site, what the concerns are for the site, what the objectives are for the site. And that's because Section 7 really relies on comparing technologies against each other. So you need two or more technologies to proceed through Section 7. And in Section 7, what we're doing is we're evaluating the technologies for their implementability at the site. And I'll go into more detail about that. Table 7.1 in the guidance document has the evaluation factors listed. We're going to select the top five evaluation factors and use those, rank those against each other. Use those to rank the technologies against each other. And you can find more about how each technology ranks on the evaluation factors in the B-series tables in Appendix A. So on slide 70, we've just got an example from table 7.1 in the tech, in the guidance document. And this is where we're just defining what we mean by each of these evaluation factors. In this case, remedial time frame, it's the time that it takes that technology, the time frame, the average time that it takes that technology to meet a goal. And, of course, the impact is that, in this particular case, all other variables being the same, you're going to select the shorter time frame. That's going to be the technology you want to select. However, realize that that's going to increase cost, at least annual costs, in order to get to the endpoint. On slide 71, these are the rest of the evaluation factors. So again, remedial time frame, safety is of course always a very big factor when you're considering what type of technology to use. Waste stream generation and how you manage that, those waste streams. Whether they're a community concern, if you're doing remediation at a corner gas station that's surrounded by a lot of residences, there could be, you know, a lot of community concerns as opposed to out in the middle of a field at a refinery or a former refinery. You might want to look at carbon footprints and energy requirements for the different technologies and understand what your overall environmental impact is going to be just from running the remediation system. Whether there are site restrictions, you know, big sites, small sites, different remediation technologies are going to have to be considered. And then things, you know, the LMAPL body size itself. Bigger LMAPL bodies really avail themselves to a larger range of technologies. Cost is also a factor, but it's really kind of inherent in all the other factors. So, you know, and we don't define cost ranges in the guidance document. And that's because you can find cost ranges for LMAPL remediation technologies, you know, out there on the web and in other guidance documents. But our concern was that they're usually fairly broad ranges because of changes over time for different technologies and regional variability in the cost of implementing these technologies. And also, as I said, it's because the site-specific cost is really going to be linked back to these other evaluation factors. On slide 72, so here's an example from the multi-phase extraction dual pump table in Appendix A, as we're evaluating these, as we're looking at the evaluation factors for this technology. So again, remedial time frame, this is, we consider the remedial time frame to be moderate for an MTE system, and it's gonna take a little bit longer if you have a higher viscosity NAPL or a lower permeability system. Community concerns are also going to be moderate. While these are generally fairly well-engineered systems and the equipment is going to be out of sight, there's noise that's generated by the system. There's potential odors or volatile emissions if your system breaks down that, you know, could arouse community concerns. So you can see on the graphic there, there's a pilot test wellhead for a MPE system. You know, the PVC pipe there is used to apply the vacuum. The large red hose is used to pump the groundwater, to draw down the groundwater, expose the smear zone, and then the small red hose is for LMAPL recovery as the LMAPL drains into the well. So on slide 73, now we've gone through the implementability of these technologies that we've screened in section 6, and then, like I said, looked at the implementability in section 7. So now again, we've gotten to the point where we want to take the next step in the few technologies, hopefully we have left. So we're going to look at the C-series tables in Appendix A to provide another level of detail that's applicable to technology selection, testing, or design. And again, you know, I'll just reiterate, fine-grained soils make for very difficult remediation. You can see the clay in the soil core there. So you really need to closely evaluate sites with fine-grained soils in the pilot testing phase. On slide 74, what we're looking at is the minimum data requirements and the critical considerations for evaluating whether your remaining technology or technologies are going to be suitable for addressing the remedial objectives and remedial goals. So in table 8.1, there's a summary of the critical information that you might need for each of the technologies we discuss in the guidance document. It's also, you can use that to evaluate whether you want to consider bench scale or pilot scale testing or developing other information for field scale deployment. And then you use the C-series tables in Appendix A for more detail about all of that. Again, if you get to this point and you don't have a technology left, that's the time when you need to go circle back, reevaluate what your concerns are for the site, what the objectives are for the site. You might identify that you need to expand the LNAPL conceptual site model and gather more data. So on slide 75, here's a line from that table 8.1, this one for natural source zone depletion. It just talks about the types of testing you might want to do to evaluate natural source zone depletion and gives some references. Of course, there's going to be even more information when you go to the C-series tables in Appendix A. And then finally on slide 76, we get to the point where we pick the technology and we need to establish goals and metrics for that technology. And that way, and we want to do that before we deploy the system so that we can then monitor the performance of the system and demonstrate when the system has met the remediation goals that we've set for it. So that's a fairly detailed look at how we do the screening of technologies for a site. Now what I want to do is I want to use a case study to show how we use these principles to select a technology for remediation. So on slide 77, the case study is going to be for a former Midwestern refinery. Talk about how the LNAPL conceptual site model was developed, looking at the chemical and physical state of the LNAPL at the site. Why do we do that? Because it helps us understand what the risks are, what the concerns are at the site, and then how best to remediate that to mitigate those concerns. Again, starting from Section 6 in the guidance document, we're going to apply this framework to get to a remediation technology that's best for the site. At this site, the main concern we want to focus on is LNAPL mass recovery. Other work was done using tracers in the LNAPL to show that the LNAPL body overall was stable, so it wasn't moving anywhere. All we needed to do was reduce the mobility within that LNAPL body, and also to show that the LNAPL didn't have a significant effect on the groundwater at the site. So on slide 78, here's an aerial photo of the site. It's a former refinery, so most of the infrastructure is gone. At this site, refining began in the early 1900s, reached a maximum capacity of 50,000 barrels a day in the mid-70s. But then the refinery was closed in the mid-80s, and as I said, was decommissioned. The site size is 1,200 acres, so it's quite a large site. And one thing that is remaining that wasn't decommissioned is that there is an on-site wastewater treatment plant, and that will become a key feature as we start to think about what technologies we might use. This is a very big site. A lot of us are going to use these principles to determine what technology we're going to use at a service station. So through the rest of this case study, I'll take little side notes about what we might do at a service station, how this relates. Slide 79, quick pass through here. We're up in that LCSM development step. On slide 80, here is a picture showing the extent of the SNEAR zone, both vertically and horizontally. So I want to make sure you understand that we're looking at the SNEAR zone, so where the LNAPL is in the soil, regardless of whether it's residual LNAPL or mobile LNAPL. So you can see that the thickness of this SNEAR zone extends up to almost 18 feet in some portions of this site. That doesn't mean that there's 18 feet of NAPL in a well. It means that there's an 18-foot interval where there is NAPL in the soil pores. So this map was developed using looking at where there are wells with NAPL in them, looking at how high the top of the NAPL in that well went, how low the bottom of the NAPL in that well went, using dissolved phase indicators, as we've talked about in previous presentations, to understand where the concentrations, constituents of the LNAPL are near the effective solubility. That's a good indicator that there's LNAPL nearby. And then using soil samples and soil screening with PIDs from soil borings to understand what the vertical extent of the LNAPL is within that soil boring. So overall, there's about 200 acres of SNEAR zone across this site. On slide 81, we've got more information about the site. So where LNAPL was present in wells, bail down tests were performed. And I think we talked about bail down testing a little bit in some of the previous presentations. And that was to determine how mobile the LNAPL is, what the LNAPL transmissivity is. And we're going to use transmissivity to focus the efforts to reduce the LNAPL mobility at the site. So what we want to do is focus on the areas of the site where the transmissivity is over 1 square foot per day. And that already narrows down our focus of the site to about 20 acres. So you can see probably where the color transitions to a yellow is where we exceed that 1 square foot per day metric. There are a number of resources that have become available since we wrote the guidance. One is the ASTM standard guide for estimation of LNAPL transmissivity, and there's a hyperlink there that you can follow to get to that. That is a guidance you'll have to purchase. And then there's also the API LNAPL transmissivity workbook, which is it has some basics about how to perform transmissivity testing, as well as an Excel worksheet that you can use to evaluate what the transmissivity is based on the bail down test data. And again, you can follow the hyperlink there. That one's free. So what about a service station? Would we have done all of this bail down testing and to evaluate the transmissivity across the site? Well, I'll say the bail down testing is almost always useful. If you can do it, it's a good way to understand how mobile the LNAPL transmissivity, how mobile the LNAPL is at a site. But you can qualitatively evaluate the mobility and the transmissivity at a site if you have relatively good LNAPL removal and in-well thickness data. You can ask questions, did the LNAPL thickness recover quickly after bailing or other short-term recovery efforts? Or how long did it take for the LNAPL to recover? And how much LNAPL has been recovered at the site over time? So you can use those sorts of questions to say, is the LNAPL highly mobile at my site? Can I recover gallons of LNAPL every time I go out there? Can I recover only a fraction of a gallon once a month? And those will give you some indication of what the mobility is at the site. On slide 82, here's a cross-section, again, back at our refinery. The soils go from some relatively fine-grained soils in the top 12 feet of the site to a 7-foot thick sand layer at the site. And in that sand layer is where the water table occurs. And even under high water table conditions, the water table never gets closer than about a foot and a half, 18 inches to the bottom of that fine overlying fine-grained layer. Below that is another lower permeability clay aquitard. So you can see also in this picture, there is a photograph of cores that were taken through that sand layer. On the left of that photograph is a natural light image of the soils. So you can see, you know, some of the banding in the soils there. And then on the right is an ultraviolet image of the soils. And you use UV because, napples fluoresce, L-napple, petroleum hydrocarbons fluoresce, and that's because of the things like the PAHs, starting with naphthalene. All of those compounds fluoresce in the napple, so you can see it, and you can see roughly by intensity how much L-napple is present. As we look at this image, we can see that, as we talked about earlier, there's going to be a distribution starting somewhere a little bit above the water table, to a few feet below the water table, where the elm apple occurs in the soil. And this is, you know, good for our conceptual model, because now we know where the elm apple is that we're going to need to recover. Slide 83. Now we're into the first part of selecting a technology. In our section 6, we're going to look at what technologies might be effective for recovering the cell metal. On slide 84, now we're in table 6.1. Our objective is to reduce L-NAPL saturation when L-NAPL is above the residual range, and more specifically, to reduce recoverable L-NAPL to the extent practical. And that's going to be our goal for whatever technology we end up implementing. At this point, since it's a big site and there's many acres of L-NAPL that we're potentially going to need to recover, we need to develop some more data to help us start to test technologies against each other. So on slide 85, we understand that the technology group we're going to use is mass recovery. But we want to know how different mass recovery technologies are going to work in different areas of the site. So we're going to do some pilot testing in two different areas of the site. They're going to have similar L-NAPL thickness in the wells, but different viscosities. So there's some areas of the site with a lower viscosity and some with a higher viscosity. And this is going to help to do a number of things to more effectively choose a technology that's going to get us to our remedial goal. So we're going to verify and refine parameters that were collected during the LCSM development, including things like transmissivity and hydraulic conductivity. So those were done with these short-term tests like a bail-down test. As we do longer-term recovery tests, that will give us an indication of what the transmissivity is over a larger portion of the soil. Using those refined data, refined parameters, we can then predict the L-NAPL recovery using this LDRM model that Ian talked about a little bit ago, the L-NAPL distribution recovery model. Again, that's available from API for free. And using that model and understanding of the different technologies will determine the most efficient technology to achieve the remedial goal. So as you go across table 6.1 on slide 86, you can see what the technologies are that come out of this portion of the evaluation. We're going to be looking at things like L-NAPL skimming, enhanced fluid recovery, which is vacuum-enhanced skimming, so skimming with a vacuum on the well, dual-pump liquid extraction, where you're doing basically skimming and extracting groundwater at the same time, and then vacuum enhanced multi-phase extraction. So the, using both the extraction of groundwater and the extraction of vapors to enhance LNAPL recovery. So what about at a service station? I mean, this is early in the process, and we're already jumping in and doing pilot testing of a bunch of different technologies. You're probably not going to do that at a service station. At a service station, you're going to walk through more of this process using the data you have in hand and coming to a few technologies, maybe just one technology, later in the screening process that you may or may not consider pilot testing. So on slide 87, let's look at where the pilot testing was done. Two different portions of the site. Again, the smear zone thickness there on the left, showing that we're looking at portions of the site where the smear zone is about the same thickness, and again, that the LNAPL that was in the wells is about the same thickness. On the right, these are portions of the site where the transmissivity is quite different, and that's because the viscosity of the NAPL in that area is different. So in the lower, in the more southern site, pilot testing site, the viscosity is one centipoise. It's about the viscosity of water. At the more northern pilot testing site, the absolute viscosity is about 22 centipoise. So that's getting up into the diesel range or a little bit heavier hydrocarbons. At a service station, you're probably not going to have, you may not have multiple NAPLs, or they'll be mixed in such a way that they'll be approximately the same viscosity, so you probably wouldn't choose two different locations for pilot testing. One would be more than enough. So on slide 88, what other technologies were indicated that might be effective for this site? Things like single pump multi-phase extraction was screened out, and that's because while there is an on-site wastewater treatment plant, it's incompatible with a combined NAPL water stream, which is what you'd get out of a single pump multi-phase extraction implementation. Water flooding was eliminated, and that's because there are regulatory issues with injecting the untreated water. And bioslurping was eliminated because we're not focusing on aerobic degradation here, but we want to focus more on that vacuum-enhanced fluid recovery portion of that. Also, NSCD, natural source zone depletion, was screened out because we're looking for the time frame for NSCD, essentially, is too long. But we want to get to this remedial objective more quickly. Also, soil excavation was screened out, mainly because there's a lot of clean overburden that would have to be handled in order to get to the LNAPL-affected soil. On slide 89, looking at the pilot test instrumentation and how we're going to collect the data for the pilot test, just quickly, put in 6-inch stainless steels at each of these pilot test locations, and that's just to eliminate any inefficiencies due to the small well diameter or PVC soiling on contact with the LNAPL that would bias the results of pilot testing. We want to understand, not worry about whether the wells were efficient enough. Also, during the pilot testing, additional soil cores were collected through the LNAPL zone, and we did some soil parameter testing on that to look at some unsaturated multi-phase flow characteristics of the NAPLs in the site-specific soils, and we use those as input to the models we'll use for predicting the performance of these different technologies. Then there were some 2-inch performance monitoring wells at various radii from the extraction wells, and that's so we can calculate a radius of influence for the vacuum and for the groundwater extraction. On slide 90 is a picture of the pilot test setup. So you can see we've got some LNAPL collection drums grounded so that we don't have any spark hazards. You can see the Elmapple discharge line coming off the top of the extraction well there, going over to those drums, as well as the groundwater extraction line and the vapor extraction line that go to, back to the system. So what did we find out on slide 91? The pilot test results showed that, in general, the vacuum-enhanced technologies didn't provide any additional benefit. So you can see in the low viscosity area, Elmapple skimming alone produced about 40 gallons of Elmapple over the 72-hour pilot test. When that was enhanced by a vacuum for the enhanced fluid recovery test, we got the same amount of Elmapple out. In the same way, dual pump liquid extraction was able to extract 600 gallons over the 72 hours, but when a vacuum was added to that, and then you call it multi-phase extraction with a dual pump, again, 600 gallons was produced. So the other thing to note here is that in the high viscosity areas, no Elmapple was recovered. So the pilot test clearly demonstrated that the low transmissivity, high viscosity areas were not hydraulically recoverable. And that shifted the focus, again, to these areas where the transmissivity was greater than 1 square foot per day, that 20-acre area we talked about initially. So on slide 92, what was going on? Why didn't the vacuum help? Well, as we go back to our conceptual site model, we look at that 18 inches of freeboard above the water table that was present in the remediation wells. And what we understand when we think about that is, as you add a vacuum, you're going to get water table mounding next to the remediation well. So what happens is the water table mounds, but quickly rises up into the lower permeability formation, effectively blocking the propagation of vacuum away from that extraction well. So, and that's confirmed because even at 8 feet from the recovery well, no vacuum was detected. So at this site, we've confirmed that vacuum-enhanced technologies aren't going to be easy to implement and aren't really going to add a lot of additional effectiveness. So as we go to slide 95, now we're going to be in section 7 and screen these remaining technologies against site-specific evaluation factors. So slide 94, we're looking at, again, now we're looking at the implementability of these remaining technologies at the site. So what sort of evaluation factors do we want to look at for the implementability? We want to look at remedial time frame. We want to look at waste stream generation and management. And we want to look at Elmapple body size. Inherent to all these is cost. So if you have a lot of waste stream generation and management problems and a long remedial time frame, then your costs are going to go up. So on slide 95, what we did is we laid out the two remaining technologies. Remember, we've eliminated the vacuum-enhanced technologies, so now we're just down to Elmapple skimming and dual-pump liquid extraction. So we've got our three evaluation factors on the left of this table and the technologies on the top axis there. So as we look at remedial time frame, we know that the time frame for skimming is going to be fairly high, as opposed to dual pump liquid extraction, where it's going to be moderate. So, you know, the importance of this is that while the dual pump liquid extraction wells are going to be more expensive to put in, a higher capital cost, the longer term O&M costs might overbalance that. You know, longer-term O&M for skimming might overbalance that initial investment. On slide 96, we can use our models to understand what that time frame is. So for the skimming, we can see the results here of the modeling. The recovery rate starts out pretty high, up around 40 gallons per day, but it declines very slowly over 10 years. And even after 10 years, even at 10 years, we're still above a recovery rate of 10 gallons per day. And you can see that neither the recovery rate nor the recovery volume are approaching any sort of asymptotic value. On slide 97, do the same analysis for the dual pump liquid extraction. What we see here is, first of all, we start up at a much higher recovery rate, so we're getting that mobile NAPL more quickly, and the effect of that is that we drop to those asymptotic rates very quickly. So after about 3 years, we're down to an asymptotic recovery rate. And you can see the red point on the graph there in the cumulative recovery volume. 90% of the recoverable NAPL has been recovered after just a little more than a year. So on slide 98, we'll go down to waste management. With L-NAPL skimming, hopefully all we're doing is recovering L-NAPL. There might be a little incidental water, but that keeps the disposal volume low, and there's a potential for recycling that L-NAPL. With dual pump liquid extraction, however, remember that in addition to all the L-NAPL you're extracting, you're going to be extracting a lot of groundwater, and you need to be able to properly dispose of that groundwater. However, we're in luck because at this site, there is an existing wastewater treatment plant, so that's something we wouldn't have to incur additional capital costs for. We only need the electricity to run the plant to be able to process that groundwater. And then finally on slide 99, we look at the L-NAPL body size evaluation factor. And the key point is that this is a big site. So while there is a cost trade-off between a lot of skimming, low-cost skimming wells versus fewer dual-pump liquid extraction wells, the scale of the remediation system is going to mute that cost difference. So we can, on slide 100, to simplify our table here, and see that, in general, dual pump liquid extraction at this site is going to be favored. We're going to get a better remedial time frame. The waste management is just as simple as for skimming, because we have the wastewater treatment plant. And while on balance, skimming and dual pump liquid extraction are going to be equally effective for an L-NAPL body this size, we're probably going to lean toward dual pump liquid extraction again because of the first two evaluation factors. On slide 101, what about a service station? Well, again, at a service station, dual pump liquid extraction is going to have a faster remedial time frame. So you're going to get to your endpoint more quickly. However, at a service station, you're unlikely to have your own wastewater management plant, wastewater treatment plant. So waste management is going to favor L-NAPL skimming, you know, lower volumes, keeping it mostly L-NAPL that you're recovering. And then at a service station, the L-NAPL body size probably also favors skimming because you're unlikely to have that large L-NAPL body where the costs become essentially the same for a dual pump liquid extraction system as opposed to a skimming system. At the service station, you want to go with the low-cost skimmer pump and the smaller enclosure, and that keeps your costs generally low. So at a service station, I think this same sort of evaluation would favor L-NAPL skimming. So finally, we're in the on slide 102. We're in the minimum data requirements section, and on slide 103, we'll look at some of the technical implementation considerations for dual pump liquid extraction, and that's from table AHC back in the Appendix A in the C-series tables. And again, this is going to give us site-specific data for evaluating the technology and also for designing the technology. So when you're going to full-scale design, what I want to highlight here is that we really want to understand the radius of capture and the radius of dewatering around those dual pump liquid extraction wells. That's where we're going to get the most effectiveness, where we can draw the water table down and mobilize that LNAPL. So understanding what that radius is lets us know how many wells we have to put in, what the well spacing is going to be. Those are going to be important design considerations so that we get to that endpoint as quickly as possible and don't leave mobile NAPL in between the remediation wells. So on slide 104, just a summary of the case study, that LNAPL remediation is an iterative process. We want to identify those concerns, and we want to step through the process so that we've selected the technology and we can use metrics to demonstrate we're meeting the LNAPL goals we've set. Communication is key, and I think this process is an excellent tool so that everybody who's involved in decisions at the site, from responsible parties to consultants to regulators, can all understand how the decisions are being made. And this technology selection framework that we've just gone through and had a case study for provides an excellent vehicle for that communication. And again, with the case study, I showed how that framework can be applied. Overall, on slide 105, this is the third part of the training series. You had, hopefully you attended parts 1 and 2 to understand the LNAPL conceptual site model and understand LNAPL science and recoverability. In today's training, we talked about the different technologies that can be used at LNAPL sites. We talked about setting remedial objectives so that you have an idea of how you're going to mitigate the concerns at the site, and then using that technology selection framework to get to a technology that's going to address those concerns and meet those objectives. As we said a couple of times, we do a classroom training, 2-day classroom training, so we take a lot of the information that's been presented in the last 6 hours of the three parts of this and expand upon that information. And in addition, we do some classroom exercises, so you can apply these principles yourself in the class with the instructors there to get advice. And then Eric also mentioned that we have a new ITRC team forming to update this LNAPL guidance, bring in the science and research that's been done over the 6-7 years since we wrote the guidance and the 5 or 6 years we've been doing these trainings. So at this point, I'll hand it back to Juliana.
Thanks, Rick. On slide 106, we have our links to additional resources. You follow this area of the slide, it's going to allow you to download the PowerPoint presentation. It's going to take you to a link where you can access the guidance document that's the basis of today's training. We also have links to where you can access, again, Part 1 and Part 2. So if you missed those or if you want to go back now, those are links that you can find. We also have a link here for our feedback form. And if you're on the links page along the left, you can look down to find the link to the feedback. We encourage everyone on the call today. If you have more than one person at your location, first person can fill out the feedback form. You can submit it, and then there's a link to go back so that you can have another person at your location complete the feedback. This is the way through the feedback that you can get the certificate of participation. We don't have another way right now, so it's just through that feedback form. So if you want the certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom. We do have a way to follow up after the class with extra questions that were asked. So if you'd like to ask questions, we're not going to have time to answer many at this point, but you're welcome to use that orange question mark at the top of the slides to send in a question. I do want to take a moment to ask a question that has come in on the simulcast, and this refers to slide 91. So remember, you can jump back along the left in that clue inversion. In slide 91, It shows that a high viscosity area had no L-NAPL recovery despite greater than 5 feet of L-NAPL in the well at static conditions. So what will be the best case for the remedy selection? If not, will the L-NAPL body remain with no remedy applied or just leave it on the site for natural attenuation processes?
That would be exactly the case. Just to clarify, in the pilot test, there were 5 feet of NAPL present in the well. That's why the well was selected. Those 5 feet of NAPL were evacuated from the well before the beginning of the pilot test. So that's why we got zero recovery. But the point is that the transmissivity is so very low in those areas that 5 feet is going to take days to weeks to maybe even months to reaccumulate in that well, which indicates that in that area you're not going to be able to reduce the L-NAPL mass very significantly at all through hydraulic recovery. So yes, so that NAPL is essentially residual, even though it will slowly accumulate in a well. It's not going to go anywhere. We already understand that there aren't any other concerns at the site. So yeah, leaving that NAPL in place to naturally degrade would probably be the decision.
Thank you. Thanks to our trainers and our participants today, we are out of time for today's class. So we'll go ahead and wrap up. If you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. More information is available on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. You can find out more about the classroom training. You can learn more about the new team and how you can be involved in this new L-NAPL update team. So I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website. Thanks again for joining us on this three-part L-NAPL training, and have a great day.